Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do on the program. On the back half of the show after the 12:30 news break, we're going to be talking about fair trade and talking with a fair trade company right here in Chicago and an event that's coming up. That's going to be really interesting. You want to stay tuned for that. And of course, we're going to be talking a little bit about insurance policies, and because that's up right now, both health insurance and a very specific and interesting kind of insurance that some employers are carrying right now. Joining us right now is Helene Olin, who is a columnist and author of Pound Foolish. She wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about how the way that we talk about the process of researching health insurance is kind of a problem. And at first it seems like it's, well, this is a matter of semantics. But in fact, once you read the piece, you will see that it is a fraught issue and it is rather nuanced. Helene, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on, and good afternoon, Chicago.
So talk us through this piece, because at its surface, it feels like, well, why does the verb matter that when we're talking about health insurance as we're looking for the right plan? But you make a very good case against the word shopping. Talk us through.
Okay. I became fascinated by how when you read or talk to people in the industry about picking a health insurance plan, they often use the word shopping, like you're going to the store, right? You're going to the store, you're shopping for a suit. You go to the store, you're shopping for a box of cereal. I don't think very many of us equate picking a health insurance plan with shopping for clothes or shopping for a box of cereal or shopping for luggage or even shopping for a cell phone plan, right? These things are, for the most part, optional. They're easy to do, and if you make a mistake, the consequences are not particularly severe. With health insurance, it's mandatory. You need to do it. And if you make a mistake, you can cost yourself massive amounts of money, major damage to your financial life, major damage to your own health, and potentially your own life, frankly. It's simply not a shopping opportunity.
Certainly. And you make a really good point. It was one of those things it's a word that's like in our vocabulary. We're using it because that's the word out there and we're not really thinking much about it. But to be more thoughtful with that word isn't just a matter of semantics. It really does matter because shopping is more than just transactional. And very importantly, as you say, there's a way to backtrack. If you in fact make a mistake, you can return it to customer service, get your money back, and make a different choice. And it's not mandatory. You're making a very good case with this. And so, what are the stakes really? By switching our language and being more thoughtful about it, not only is it more accurate, but in your mind, what will that help us to solidify or undo?
Well, I think the thing with the use of the word shopping, what it really comes down to, is that it puts all the onus on you or me, right? In other words, if we get this wrong, it's on us. At the same time, it puts the onus on you or me or any of our listeners to battle the health industry industrial complex, which, as we all know, is massive, huge amounts of money, eating up more and more of our economy with each passing year. It puts it on 300 million plus Americans to battle this one by one. And it says that we can do that. And if we fail at it, if we're wrong, it's on us. So a perfect example is when last year when Hillary Clinton was holding a town hall and a woman came to her and said, I think everybody should have health insurance. I was a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, but my insurance went up. It almost tripled, basically, was the number was the woman gave her since the Affordable Care Act. And what do you want me to do? Hillary Clinton responded, keep shopping, because what you're telling me is much higher than what I hear from other families. And in other words, the woman was in the wrong. And it puts the onus on us. And then ultimately what it does is it makes it seem like it's our fault, and it channels our energy not into fighting the system as it is now and insisting on changes that would be better for a lot of people. And those changes can be up to the individual, right? Though I obviously have my own beliefs on that, and you probably do as well. But it supports the system as it is now, which very few people think is very good.
Right, right. I mean, I know in my case, personally, I picked, when I had to pick health insurance just the other day, I picked the most affordable plan. It really wasn't an option of do I pick, of how many can I pick from? It was really like, well, that's what I can afford. There we are. I hope it covers everything I might possibly need. And I know I'm not alone in that. I think a lot of people make selections in that way and really have to put put the budget ahead of need.
Right, but also keep in mind, it's only guesswork, right? First of all, you're picking it probably based on premiums, I'm guessing, but you actually don't know how much the plan is going to pick up. So, in fact, a plan that costs more might actually, in the end, cost you less, right? You can't predict the future. You can't predict how often you're going to go to the doctor, what you're going to need to go to the doctor for, how ill you could possibly be, will you need to go to a hospital? Do you want me to keep going?
Right.
And so on down the line, right? This is impossible, in other words. We're taking the blame for something that no other first world country or industrialized country makes their citizens do. And it is a disgrace.
You certainly make a great case in your piece in New York Times. And if you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and share a link to this piece after so everyone can read it. There is one particular sentence I want to read from the piece. It's in the second to last paragraph. It says, it also signals that instead of contemplating how to make the medical industrial complex work for us, our energy is channeled into getting the best deal we can from a system that's designed not for our benefit, but to extract the greatest amount of profit from every patient, which I think is a very, very powerful sentence in this piece. And so beyond our language, I think there's probably a lot of people listening going, well, what does it matter if I say one word or the other? I personally believe that language does matter, and I think it can have an impact on shifting narratives. Beyond that, what are some things that you would like people to do and actions you would like them to take?
Well, the stakes are that we are turning healthcare into not a right, but a consumer item. I believe, and I hope many of your listeners believe, that healthcare is a right. It is fundamental to our lives. We cannot live without it. And what I would like to see happen is more along the lines of what we saw happen this past winter and spring when people confronted members of Congress when they were attempting to overturn the Affordable Care Act and said, not just, you can't do this, this could cost me my life, but we need greater reform. We need to guarantee affordable, universal health care for everyone. And that is the important point. Again, no other country but us handles it this way. It's not right. And every time we use the word shopping to describe the onerous, unpleasant, miserable process of picking a health insurance plan, we are, without even realizing it, supporting the current system by using its language and imposing its values on ourselves.
Certainly. And another point that you make in the piece is really about even if you can easily afford any plan that you want on the healthcare exchange, the idea of going through it all, reading the prospectus, understanding all of it, and there was data supporting all the things many Americans would rather do instead of go through all that data and fully comprehend it. It is confusing. It is very difficult. So there's a lot to it. Thank you so much, Helene Olin, columnist and author of Pound Foolish. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and share this op-ed that appeared in the New York Times. Thanks for being with us today, Helene.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, we're going to take a little break, come back in just a bit, and we're going to keep talking about insurance, but this time shift away from health insurance and talk about a very interesting and rather controversial type of liability insurance that some companies are carrying right now. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Hope you're staying warm and dry wherever you are. It's warming up a little bit today. By this evening, it's going to be warmer. We'll keep checking in upstairs on that weather, but I hope you are nice and dry. See lots of very festive and creative umbrellas out there on Michigan Avenue today. Still lots to do on the program today. We're joined now by Danielle Paquette, who is a reporter at Washington Post, who wrote about the phenomenon of how more companies are taking out insurance policies to cover executives who might sexually harass employees. I know that topic is a big one right now. We're seeing many examples of it in a very high profile way. But nonetheless, there's insurance for everything. So why not this? Danielle, welcome to the program.
Hey, Amy.
Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us.
Oh, happy to be here talking about what I find to be an important topic.
Yes, it's a very interesting one. You know, we joke about, oh my gosh, there's insurance for everything. But this one, not a joke, a real thing. And one we're seeing in very powerful ways right now in our headlines. So talk us through this, if you would.
Right. So what this is technically called is employer practices liability insurance. It's been around for about 20 years. And from here on out, we can just call it sexual harassment insurance, even though it also covers discrimination, wrongful firing. But even a decade ago, it was pretty uncommon. There are still employers, small business owners in particular, who weren't sure if they needed or had never heard of it. But in the last 5 years, there's just been a real surge. And even over the last 12 months, as all of these sexual harassment, high-profile scandals are dominating the headlines, employers have really been ramping up their coverage. You know, one example I used in the story was Nationwide. One of the country's largest insurers saw a 15% uptick in these policies being purchased. And carriers across the country tell me that anytime there's something like Harvey Weinstein or Roger Ailes or Bill O'Reilly in the headlines with stories about powerful men, victims saying that or accusing them of sexually harassing them at work, there's always more interest around defending themselves from what can be extremely expensive lawsuits.
And when we're looking at the numbers that you uncovered here, they're really quite significant. U.S. companies spent an estimated $2.2 billion last year on insurance policies covering the legal fallout from sexual harassment, racial discrimination, and unfair dismissal accusations. So that's a significant amount of money, and it's projected to grow up to $2.7 billion by 2019. Immediately, though, I mean, this seems like, well, this feels like a Band-Aid rather than confronting the problem head on and dealing with sexual harassment in the workplace and discrimination and helping reform that behavior and the culture that supports it. This feels like putting a big old Band-Aid on it.
Well, that's what I'm hearing from some lawyers and victim advocates. These insurance policies, they will cover all those damages paid to a victim after such a lawsuit. Or even if their lawyer just tells their employer, hey, this happens, let's settle. Well, virtually all of these settlements come with confidentiality agreements. These companies aren't telling their employees what happened. The man or woman who encountered harassment in the workplace can't say anything. They're legally bound not to. And so advocates are saying the cycle continues. There's really nothing that forces these predators or harassers out of the workplace. No one really wants to talk about their problems, and therefore it's harder to address them. But at the same time, companies get lower premiums on insurance like this if they can prove they have anti-harassment trainings or some kind of other thing that might lower their risk. So I'm hearing again and again there's plus to this, but there's also a large minus.
Certainly. And I'm sure there are listeners right now saying, yes, but what about people who are falsely accused? What about that? How does this fit into their things that perhaps is costly to investigate, maybe is dropped later, or maybe ends up someone settling for something and no one really knows the truth of what happened except the two involved?
Right. And you're hearing that when you talk to insurance agents. They're billing this policy to business leaders saying, hey, you really can't know what's truly going on between all of your employees in the workplace. You might not think you have a problem. Maybe you have someone who has, you know, an agenda against you. Well, this will defend you and clear your innocent name and make it all go away. But, you know, there's another side of this coin. So say you're someone who has truly encountered brutal harassment in your workplace, and your employer happens to not have any cash or liquidity, the kind of stuff that could cover a settlement to make what you've gone through or at least give you the resources to heal, take time off work, to seek out therapy. So these policies will give some victims more of an opportunity to even get some redress because now there's this pocket of money there for them.
That is an interesting point, too. I'm glad you made that point. And so where can we look next? Are we looking, you know, we're looking at these numbers that suggest that this is going to go way up. Is this going to, in your feeling in reporting all this and talking with people involved in this very closely, did you get the sense that this will be quite a bit more widespread, that we'll see more and more companies taking out such policies?
You'll see more types of companies taking out such policies. Today, most large firms already have some kind of insurance against sexual harassment. But in recent years, we're seeing this large upswing in small companies, startups, medium-sized firms saying, hey, maybe this is something I should invest in. And part of the reason they're spending more money on these plans is because insurers, because this is a relatively new kind of coverage, insurers now know the true risk associated with each company. The premiums are rising because you're seeing more and more and more claims. And one reason you're seeing more claims is because people know more than ever what sexual harassment is, and they feel more empowered to report it in the first place.
Certainly. Did you also get the sense that perhaps this will maybe help some corporate cultures as they're seeking out more anti-harassment training to get the premiums down? I mean, I hate that it's financially motivated, but hey, whatever gets it there. Did you get the sense in talking to people about this that maybe there is a longer game here, that it, in the long run, it will be beneficial because then more companies will be seeking out this kind of training and more conversations will be happening in the workplace?
I'm serious. I'm hearing those kind of thoughts. I talked to one insurance company president in Washington last week who said one of his largest clients who already has such a plan asked him for the first time ever, what can I do truly to make sure this never happens? Yes, they wanted to avoid a lawsuit, but they also wanted to avoid the kind of damages, that kind of true hurt that comes with each one of these cases. So these conversations are happening behind the scenes. No one really wants to talk about whether or not they have a problem, it makes them look bad. It might make the institution look bad. But at the end of the day, what I'm hearing from everyone involved is that no one is truly safe from something like this. We all need to encounter this problem head on to have any hope of reducing claims, reducing harm, and moving forward in the workplace.
Certainly. Well, it certainly seems like in a very interesting time with some recent, social campaigns like the Me Too campaign and the headlines we're seeing of very high-profile people in positions of great power who've been accused of numerous sexual harassment complaints. I think it is a very interesting time, and I think it's important to be having these conversations more openly. So thank you for writing this piece, and thank you for joining us today. Danielle Paquette, reporter at Washington Post.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I hope that you are keeping warm and dry wherever you're listening from today. As you may have heard, it's going to warm up a little bit by this evening, but nonetheless, we got to stay warm and dry. And, every time over the summer, you all heard me many times, I was saying, get out there, get the sunshine. Our February selves will thank us. I think our November selves are thanking us, too, for soaking up all that sunshine, especially on days like today. Anyway, still lots to talk about today on the program. We are joined in studio. We don't often have guests right here in studio. We have Catherine Bissell Cordova here, and we have Jonit Buchheim. Jonit is a partner at Mata Traders, which is a fair trade company here in Chicago that works with women's cooperatives in Nepal and India, producing women's clothing. And Catherine is the executive director of Chicago Fair Trade, which is holding an event coming up that we're going to talk all about. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. Well, I want to talk a little bit more broadly about fair trade and what all that involves, because I think it's a word that gets thrown around a lot. But to start, Catherine, perhaps you could tell us a bit about Chicago Fair Trade and the work that you do there.
Sure. So fair trade is an alternative trade system, which basically, in a real nutshell, is just following the golden rule in trade, where workers are treated well, they work in safe conditions, they're paid fair wages, they work in environmentally sound fashion. It also, no child labor. And it, one of the principles, there's nine principles, I won't elaborate them all, but it prioritizes working with people who are marginalized. So, and it's something that's been around for a while. Some people say the first fair trade store got its roots here in the United States, which is in 1946, which is now 10,000 villages, which many of you may have heard of. It's very, very big in Europe, especially in England. For example, in England at Starbucks, 100% of coffee is fair trade, but it's a very consumer driven thing. And there it's because consumers are driving it. So what we've done in Chicago, we started, our organization became a independent organization in 2006. We started in 2005 as a project of the International Anti-Poverty Organization, Oxfam. But we spun off and became our own organization in 2006 with a mission of educating people about fair trade, raising awareness of fair trade. And we really find it's something that's an easy concept for people to grasp and a very, very good, positive way for everyone every day to just support the creation of a more fair world for and lift people help lift people out of poverty.
And we like to think that that is that applies to all companies. We like to think, oh, well, sure, everybody's being treated nicely. Well, when you start backtracking through supply train systems chains. And all that in yeah. chains, it suddenly it doesn't always add up
not
that way.
Not so much. But yeah, we just believe business can be used as a force for good, which is an idea that's really growing and catching on. But so when we started in 2006, well, so in addition to educating people about fair trade, we find out that once they know about it, they want it. It's because it's a very easy,
Easy to feel good about it.
It's
and
easy
be on
to
board
feel good
that.
About. It's sure. easy to, it's something you can do every day, which, and I'm optimistic enough. I think a lot of people do want to do good, but sometimes you don't know how, but fair trade's such an easy way where every single day, whatever coffee or tea you pour in your cup in the morning to what clothing you put on your back, you can really be, voting with your dollars.
Certainly.
So we have found it to be extremely popular, but back in 2006, even there weren't that many products. So we've also part of our mission is to help bolster, and create access to fair trade products.
Certainly.
So when we started out in 2006, we had 24 what we call institutional members. We're a coalition. We're a membership organization. We have individual members, academics. So DePaul and Loyola are members, faith-based members. We've got different congregations and ecumenical groups that are members. And they're the ones who really put fair trade on the map in the early days. We have nonprofit members such as Oxfam, and then we have business members. And when we started out, we had 24 what we call institutional members. Three of those were business members. 11 years later, Mata Traders joined in 2007. It's their 10th anniversary. But fast forward to today, and we have 60 locally owned fair trade business members in Chicago. And Chicago is the epicenter of fair trade.
I don't think that's widely known.
I don't either.
I don't
now, a lot of these companies just so are not retailers, they're wholesalers. So, and Janique can tell you more about Mata. They're all over, I think, in 12 countries or something like that on four continents or something.
Well,
but it's based here in Chicago, but also, as you mentioned, working in Nepal and India.
Right. Well, you set that segue up for me perfectly.
Janique, thank you.
Tell us about Mata Traders and the work that you do.
Yeah, Mata Traders is a social purpose fashion enterprise based here in Ravenswood in Chicago. And so our company was founded 10 years ago by me and my two best friends, Michelle and Maureen. And
that always helps, building any kind of project when you're friends with the people you're working with.
Yeah, we met the first day of freshman year moving into the dorms and just really clicked. And after we graduated, started traveling. And that included, we saved up our money for a round-the-world trip and spent 4 months in India. Just fell in love with the handcraft there. And my friend Maureen had the idea to import because she just loved the textiles and handcraft. So it's just grown from there. But she did recognize a niche in the market for fair trade fashion that was cute and wearable here in Chicago. So she sought out some women's cooperatives that were doing sewing work and using those gorgeous Indian textiles made fashion like dresses, tops, skirts that were sellable here. And she worked, she got booths at different markets and street festivals here in Chicago in the summers. And just it's grown from there. And now in Ravenswood in our office, that's where we do the design and the marketing and sales and warehouse, shelves and shelves of clothing and jewelry. And there's 20 of us in Chicago, and then we work with hundreds of artisans in India and Nepal. We work with 5 sewing groups that train and employ women and from marginalized communities, from urban slums and rural areas. And the work really does make a huge difference, not just in their lives, but especially in the lives of their children, because they can afford to send them to school, and also their communities. It really has like a great ripple effect.
Certainly, certainly. And so by shopping at Modetraders, people know this came from a woman. I'm supporting her and her family and her children and her things that she's doing, things that she's working towards in her life.
Exactly. Yeah. When you buy a Moda dress, you know that it was produced fairly, but not only that, that it has such a big impact with the wages they earn. We've asked, well, what do you do with the wages that you earn from one dress? They can buy rice for their whole family for a week, or the flour to make chapati, which is like Indian, kind of like a tortilla, mm-hmm. that is very common for their meals. So it's really like has a tangible impact in their lives. They can send their kids to school, and that's really what, when we ask them, you know, what's the benefit of working here? That's the first thing. Like, my kids graduated from college, and these are women who never had an education themselves. They grew up real poor, and they didn't have those opportunities. So they're just so, it's just a huge thing for them to be able to not only send their kids through primary school, high school, but even college.
Sure, sure. Basic things that most people want for their families to be able to provide for them, for sure. And so we're coming up on an event, Global Fest. It's happening on Friday, November 17th. A lot is going on. That's where your paths really cross here. Tell us about that, if you would, Catherine.
Sure. I think since our second year of existence, we've had Global Fest every fall, which is our annual fundraiser and celebration of all things fair trade. We are having it, it's from 5:30 to 9 at the National Museum of Mexican Art in Pilsen.
Oh, that place is,
which is
so
a
fun.
Wonderful place,
yeah.
Yes. The really nice thing about it, too, is the museum normally closes at 5, but we're going to, they'll keep the galleries open, the exhibits open, and the Day of the Dead exhibit will still be up. And that's a very popular and crowded exhibit.
Highly
so
recommend that exhibit. It's
wonderful.
Very good.
So people can come, and if they get there before 7, they can have, you know, run of the galleries when they're not very crowded with the guests from Global Fest. We have international buffet of, we're going to have biryani, we're going to have tamales, we're going to have a whole,
I mean, that alone will get me
food.
To show up. There you
I
go.
Can be bribed with food.
Well, wait. We're also Colectivo Cafe, which is a new company to come to Chicago, but legendary in Wisconsin. They have 13 cafes in Milwaukee and 3 in Madison, and they serve the majority of their coffee's fair trade. They're sending a couple, they opened in Lincoln Park in May, and they're sending a couple baristas to do a pour over coffee bar, and Glazed and Infused is donating all the donuts that we want. So we're going to have a donut bar and a coffee bar. So all sorts of food. We're going to have fair trade wine. We're going to have local craft beer. And it's really, and the ticket price includes all of that. And one of the highlights too is that we give out this year we're giving out two because we've got worthy people in Chicago, Changemaker Awards. And that's something we've always done since the beginning. And that is to a person or company or organization that has really just gone above and beyond in elevating fair trade and just being real champions of fair trade. So this year it was very easily for our board to decide that Mata Traders was long overdue, actually, for winning the award, for receiving the award. It's their 10th anniversary. It was in October, I think, just this past month. And so they've just been huge parts of Chicago fair trade ever since the beginning. Joneet here was on our board for many years. Natalie Cruz, her colleague, is now on our board. Every time we need anything or to do anything fair trade, we just hosted a student summit where we educate future leaders. We invite students from campuses all over the Chicagoland area to learn about making their campuses into designated fair trade universities. We just had it at Mata Traders. It's anytime you need anything, I call Mata Traders, and they're amazing. And the other person we're giving the award to is a local radio personality, Jerome McDonald, mm-hmm. who has a wonderful program, Worldview, a program at noon on WBEZ. I'm allowed to say that, right?
Of course.
Just kidding. 91.5 FM.
And it is an excellent show.
It's an excellent show with a global focus, but based locally. So it's kind of a perfect. And he has been a champion of Chicago fair trade since the get-go. Every May, we've done a large World Fair Trade Day event. We've had it in Daly Plaza for, I think, 9 years, where we're in the heart of downtown Chicago, letting all sorts of people know we have a a marketplace. We have, we've had interactive activities, exhibits, installations. And Jerome, for the past 4 years, has broadcast live from the program. In addition to that, he always shops fair trade. He's wonderful. His wife, I know, has Mata Trader outfits, and he's a real champion. And he's emceed it, and we said this year, why don't you just come be a guest and receive the award? So
excellent.
He'll be there, too. We also have a wonderful silent auction.
You got a lot going on. And you have a pop-up shop coming. I want to talk about that. We have to take a quick break, but I want to tell people about the pop-up shop and where they can find out more about both of these organizations. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We've been talking with Joneet Bookheim, who is a partner at Mata Traders, a fair trade company here in Chicago, and with Catherine Bissell Cordova, the executive director of Chicago Fair Trade. And we've been talking all about Fair Trade, their two organizations, their upcoming event on Friday, November 17th, which if you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and tweet out a link to it so that you can all go and find out all about it. But right before the break, we were talking a bit about really what Fair Trade is all about and what it means and how we can do it. Because I think we, as you said, Catherine, I think everybody kind of wants to do the right thing. At least we think we do. But when it actually comes down to doing it, it's like, well, it's easier to go to the grocery store than it is to get that CSA box and drive across town to get it. You know, I think then it becomes like about convenience, right? So, and then there's the issue of how do we even know that we're, you know, is there fair trade regulation, things like that? Because just with like on products that we buy that say natural or organic, things like that, we think, oh, this is natural. It's got a green label. I'm good, right? Is fair? Do you run into those issues with fair trade of maybe things that just say that, but or is there a regulating body around that?
Yeah, so there are ways that consumers can be sure that the products that are claiming that they're fair trade are, and that their workers are getting paid well and treated fairly. So one way is to see if they are part of a membership organization that does a level of verifying. So, for example, here in the U.S., one of those organizations is the Fair Trade Federation, which Mata Traders is a part of. So they have a pretty complicated and stringent application process, and then every year we have to go through it again. So they're making sure that what our claims are true. And then the producer groups that we work with in India and Nepal are also part of an organization called the World Fair Trade Organization that also does like a guarantee system to ensure that they're actually practicing those principles of fair trade that we claim to be. And then another way I would say is for consumers to just, if they're interested in a brand, go on their website, like on our website, on MataTraders.com. We have tons of stories and video and ways that you can learn more about the artisans. And that's actually part of our mission as a company, is to really be that connection between the maker of the dress and the wearer of the dress, so that there's not this long, obscure, opaque supply chain. We want it to be real transparent.
Yeah.
So when you're buying a dress, you can feel really connected to the woman who sewed it.
Certainly.
I would also say when it comes to, in fair trade, in real simple terms, there's kind of two camps of products. There's the artisan products like and handmade products like the dresses, the jewelry, the home decor. But then with farm products, that there's actually a third party certification seal, much like you would see on organic. Like now you don't really say organic. If you say organic and there's not a seal, you don't believe it. And with fair trade, there's three different seals that are recognized in the United States that say fair trade. So if that's on it, you know.
All yeah, important things. True. And you have a pop-up shop
we
coming
do.
Out, and I know we're running out of time,
yeah,
but I want to talk about that for sure.
2200 North Clark Street, starting at 3 o'clock on Friday after Thanksgiving, the 24th of November. Mata Traders will be there, along with 32 other Chicago Fair Trade business members under one roof. In Lincoln Park, we did it last year. It's fabulous. And I think also people that have no idea just the quality and breadth of products that there are by Chicago, locally owned Chicago businesses. And one thing also, most of these businesses are women owned. I'd say over 80% of our business members are women owned. So you're supporting women-owned, local, fair trade, all sorts of
excellent.
Good things.
So if you don't feel like battling the Black Friday crowds, you can just go right there and feel really good about
fair
your purchases.
Fair is the new black is going to be our hashtag for that Friday.
Sure, certainly. Well, Jonit Bookheim from Mata Traders and Catherine Bissell-Cordova from Chicago Fair Trade. Thank you so much for being with us today and talking all about the important work that you're doing. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet out links to all the stuff we talked about so you can find it all, support these businesses, check in with them, see what they're doing, all that good
and
stuff.
Go to Global Fest.
And go to Global Fest. Again, that's coming up on Friday, November the 17th. If you go to chicagofairtrade.org, you will find all about, there's a whole page devoted to Global Fest 2017. So check that out for sure. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.